Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 575, Interview with Robert Perry. This has been recorded on November 5th of the year 2006. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to be joined by Robert Perry, the maven, so to speak, of the Consortium News website and the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thanks, Dave.
We are, as of 2 days from now, on the we're going to be witnessing another election here, and hopefully for most of us participating in another election. And the incumbent president is utilizing warfare and propaganda and all manner of things vis-a-vis the war on terror, Osama bin Laden, the war in Iraq, to scare people into the Republican camp. One of the things that you have pointed out in numerous articles on the Consortium News website is that, in a sense, not only are Bush and bin Laden best of enemies, but that there is a very real degree of symbiosis between the two, a symbiosis that goes both ways. Why don't we begin the analysis of that phenomenon with something that you have noted and that is also something that a lot of listeners to this program are aware of, namely the fact that Bush and bin Laden actually have a history of business associations.
Well, sure. Even going back to the very first company that George W. Bush started, one of his investors was also the person representing Salem bin Laden. Salem bin Laden was the older half brother of Osama bin Laden, and he was operating a lot in Texas, and he was investing in various business opportunities in Texas. And it's never been clear that the bin Laden money got directly into the Bush company, but the middleman named Bath, who was a friend of Bush, was representing Salem bin Laden and obviously handling some of his investments and also invested into Bush's company. So there was certainly some assistance there, whether or not it was a direct investment or not. And of course, if you take the George H.W. Bush, he was involved with the Carlyle Group, and as a consultant and advisor, and someone who helped them out making contacts in the Middle East. And the Carlyle Group was also heavily backed by the bin Laden family. And so it happens that on the morning of September 11th, 2001, there was a meeting of the Carlyle Group in Washington, D.C., and members of the bin Laden family were there. And as was George H.W. Bush, the former president, and former Secretary of State James Baker. And I've been told that after the planes struck the Twin Towers, the bin Ladens immediately took off their name tags. As we know, were fairly quickly spirited out of the country in the next few days to avoid any possible danger to them. So there's always been this strange, very curious relationship between the Bushes and the bin Ladens, as the Bushes are heavily involved have been heavily involved in the oil industry, and of course the bin Ladens were a major company in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's also the younger George Bush was actually placed on the board of directors of, I think it was Skychef. It was one of the many properties of Carlyle, which prepared airlines, prepared meals, I should say, for air travelers. So they made sure to get W on board, literally, I guess, in this case, for business purposes. Numerous articles that you have published on the Consortium News website, Robert, make the point that, in fact, George Bush's policies in the Middle East, Iraq in particular, have been of benefit, concrete benefit, to the policies that have been pursued by Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, et al. I wonder if you would develop that for us. The war on terror, is it really something to which Osama bin Laden is opposed, or is it something that benefits him?
Well, if you look back at where al-Qaeda was in the late 1990s, and the early part of George W. Bush's presidency, they were fairly marginalized. They were not appealing very much to the Arab world. They were many of their leaders had been defeated in various power plays. That's why they were pretty much all exiled. You had Zawahiri, who was an Egyptian exile. You had Zarqawi, who was a Jordanian exile. You had bin Laden himself, who was a Saudi exile. So they were, they'd been chased pretty much out of every country they tried to pull a power play in. They even got kicked out of the Sudan in the late 1990s, and they were hiding out in, at sort of the ends of the earth in these caves in Afghanistan. So that was their position, and they were trying to basically recover with this extraordinary plan to attack inside the United States, a plan that was probably complicated. It might well have been stopped if there had been some more aggressive response by the early Bush administration. But as you know, the Bush administration at that point was not taking counterterrorism very seriously. They were looking at other issues more heavily. They were looking at China. They were looking at missile defense. Those kinds of things were like higher on the agenda than terrorism. So when 9/11 happened, it also did not really help bin Laden all that much immediately, because there was a tremendous reaction across the world, including the Muslim world, of horror and disgust at what al-Qaeda had done. And of course, Bush went after them in Afghanistan, attacked and ousted the Taliban, but then essentially let bin Laden off the hook. He was cornered in Tora Bora. According to some accounts, he held a meeting where he apologized to his followers for having led them to this disastrous end. He knew how despised al-Qaeda was throughout the Islamic world for the taking of so much innocent life. And then he and some of his followers got on horses and fled, and they were shocked, surprised to find that the Americans had left the sort of the back door open. They were counting on both the Afghan warlords and the Pakistani army to sort of do the heavy lifting, and they didn't. So bin Laden was able to escape, as along with Zawahiri and some other key figures in the organization. And then Bush turned his attention to Iraq, and by going into Iraq, which was not involved in 9/11, which was not involved in this sort of Islamic terrorism, which was actually a secular state that was opposed to al-Qaeda, was considered an enemy of al-Qaeda because Saddam was very ruthless when he dealt with Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. He would often just execute them. So this was a case where Bush, either not understanding or not caring or having other interests, went into this country of Iraq, eliminated one of bin Laden's chief adversaries in the Muslim world, and then created a situation that produced tremendous sympathy for more radical approaches. The insurgency began in Iraq. Some al-Qaeda operatives around Zarqawi were able to move into the heartland of Iraq. The radicalism of the Islamic world increased. Bin Laden went from being sort of a total outcast to being a lot closer to the mainstream. He was seen by more and more people as a prophet, having predicted this idea of an American or Western assault on Islam. So he was allowed to sort of build his forces back up, or with at least the sympathy of many people in the Arab world. And as you know, in the National Intelligence Estimate of April 2006, the U.S. intelligence community concluded that the Iraq war had become the cause celeb that had allowed the Islamic militancy and terrorism to spread around the globe. It was, in fact, a tremendous shot in the arm for terrorism, not this effort to really stop it. So Bush's strategies have again and again played into al-Qaeda's hands, and there's been sort of a return favor. As the CIA also felt, the CIA analytical division also felt that when Bush was in trouble in the 2004 election, it was considered pretty close, going down to the wire. And if you remember, on October 29th, 2004, bin Laden broke nearly a year of silence, took some tremendous personal risk to get out a videotape, which was mostly denouncing George Bush. And the American right quickly spun it as an endorsement of John Kerry. Polls showed that Bush's numbers jumped about 5 points in that final weekend before the election. And was clearly a huge help to Bush's campaign. And that evening, on the evening of October 29th, when CIA analysts, including Deputy Director McLaughlin, got together to review what was going on that day with terrorism, they discussed how bin Laden, in their view, had done this with the expressed intent of helping George Bush. Sort of the, he was playing Brer Rabbit to our Brer Fox. He was, you know, he was saying, you know, please don't throw me in that briar patch. Please don't elect George W. Bush, when that was exactly what he wanted. So, and we've seen there's good reason for that, because as the Bush policies have gone forward and created more and more hatred of America throughout the world, and especially in the Muslim world, this has been essentially a godsend to Osama bin Laden. So we've had on that side, this tremendous assistance that has worked for bin Laden's advantage. And we also have, for Bush, he's been able to use the war on terror as a way to both consolidate Republican power, as he did in 2002 and 2004. He's been able to push this idea of this all-powerful president. He's asserted what he calls plenary powers. That means unlimited powers as commander in chief. In other words, he can do whatever he wants. In his view, he can put Americans in jail without trial. He can authorize torture. He can do anything under his theories of plenary powers. So he's been able to build himself up as the war president, the decider, essentially operating almost really outside the U.S. Constitution, outside the law. He's been issuing all these signing statements that say basically he can interpret the laws as he sees fit, and then he can ignore the Constitution when he sees fit. So he's been able to build this tremendous power base. He's had most of these 6 years, he's had pretty much the way he wants things to work in Washington. He now almost has control of full control of the Supreme Court, which would give him sort of the final piece of the puzzle. He certainly has four justices who will pretty much say whatever he wants. And so he has used bin Laden to help consolidate his power in the United States, pretty much the way bin Laden has used George Bush to rally sympathy and support in the Islamic world. So in that sense, this has been symbiotic. Both sides are helped.
I want to reiterate and emphasize a point that you made, Robert. On the eve of the 2004 election, Osama bin Laden broke an almost year-long silence and had a speech that, or a videotape, publicized by Al Jazeera initially and then carried around the world, that attacked George Bush. And that evening, Mr. McLaughlin, one of the top officials of the CIA, sat down with other cohorts at Langley and concluded at that time that the overall purpose of bin Laden's address was to strengthen George Bush. In other words, this doesn't come from some sort of screaming leftist or some knee-jerk liberal, as the Republicans like to say. This comes from the Central Intelligence Agency, whose headquarters is named for Bush's father.
Right, and I think this is the view that the CIA and the analytical division has held fairly consistently. They've been very skeptical and critical of how Bush has handled this war on terror. They feel that he has acted in he's overreacted. He's had a blunderbuss approach, which has made things worse, at least in terms of really trying to contain or isolate these extremists. He's in a sense played into their hands, but it's worked very well for Bush too. And if you remember, if you go back to that period of 2004, there were a lot of conservatives, David Brooks, for instance, of the New York Times, who were on the offensive against the CIA because they wanted to shut down the CIA's information, which, as it came out, was increasingly critical of what Bush had done. Their analysis, which I think has turned out to be accurate, was that by overreacting, by invading Iraq, which had nothing really to do with 9/11 in the first place, by really twisting the intelligence, that Bush had worsened the situation vis-a-vis terrorism in the world. But it had worked very well for Bush politically, and it continues to this day to be used by Bush. If you listen to some of these stump speeches he's been giving in the last week, they're essentially a medley of all these arguments that he's thrown together over the last 4 or 5 years, and basically what he's telling the American people is to be very, very afraid that he will protect them. He argues over and over again that his approach means that, you know, that he will fulfill the most fundamental job in government, which he says is protecting the American people. And obviously, many people in America, many of the even conservatives, believe that the real fundamental job of any president is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, more so even than individual Americans, because we are defined by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that is paramount as what America and the American government must protect, even more than individuals, citizens. So, but Bush has played this card repeatedly. He's used the fear of and the memory of 9/11 very effectively. And that's what the agency has been seeing too. And I was just reading this new book by Tyler Drumheller of On the Brink, which is Drumheller was in charge of CIA operations in Europe during much of this time, and he describes that while there needed to be some reaction, obviously in terms of responding to Al Qaeda, that what Bush did instead was exploit fear and really scare the American people way beyond what was wise to do. And if you're interested in trying to control and limit this danger, instead it's been used repeatedly to help Bush out politically.
One of the points that Bush has been making on the stump, so to speak, on the electoral campaign trail, has been that people should vote for him because if the Democrats get in, they're going to cut and run in Iraq, and this would be a victory for the terrorists, and we must not do that. And one of the points you've made in a number of your articles is that, and this is something you've already touched on, but I'd like you to develop this at greater length because it's a major theme of the Bush campaign, which is that although Bush is saying we've got to stay the course or amend the course, but stay the course, I mean, the usual equivocation that is being indulged in at this point, vis-a-vis Iraq, actually, once again, people in positions of analytical influence within the intelligence community and within the military have come to a very, very different conclusion about just what the Iraq war is doing, not only to the United States, but how the Iraq war is affecting the Muslim world and terrorism.
Right. For quite a while, from really 2003 through the fall of 2005, Bush presented to the American people the picture that the Iraq insurgency was really a case of Islamic terrorists attacking peace-loving Iraqis. That was how he sold it to the American people, and that was opposed because it wasn't true. It was opposed by the military, the U.S. military, and the U.S. intelligence community. They were saying that really wasn't what they were seeing. What they were seeing was that the vast majority of the resistance or insurgency or the violence in Iraq at that time was being carried out by Iraqis against people they saw as occupiers, the American forces, and as well as some of the Iraqis who were collaborating with the Americans, especially in the Shiite community. So that was sort of the shape of things as it was being viewed by the U.S. military and U.S. intelligence community on the ground. But Bush obviously saw a political advantage in sort of having it be portrayed as terrorists attacking Iraqis. In reality, probably the numbers of sort of al-Qaeda-type foreign jihadists never amounted to more than 5 to 10%, according to most estimates. This was Zarqawi's group. They carried out some spectacular suicide bombings and so forth, but they were not nearly as significant a force as Bush tried to present them. And he maintained this sort of fiction until fall of 2005, when he was finally kind of convinced to really start being a little more realistic. And he did start saying in his speeches that there were three parts. There were of the insurgency, and there were the people who were just opposed to the new government, mostly the Sunnis. There were the diehards around from Saddam Hussein's group, and the smallest group he acknowledged was this group of terrorists. So he began to accept that, but he's always sort of slid back into this sort of strange definition, and now he's portraying to the American people that if the United States pulls out of Iraq, the Al Qaeda will win, that Islamic terrorism will build its caliphate, which he said the other day. Initially, it would cover from Spain to Indonesia. This would be a terrorist caliphate. Caliphate being a government entity that is sort of almost mythical in Islam. Now, so he's again trying to scare the American public with this idea. There's really no basis to it, and we know based on intercepted communications, the U.S. intelligence community understands this anyway, and the U.S. military, that based on these communications, the position of the Al Qaeda forces in Iraq is extremely fragile. There was a letter that was has been widely misinterpreted by Bush and his people, but it was the letter from attributed to Zawahiri, the number two man in Al Qaeda, that was sent to Zarqawi in July of 2005, and in that, Zawahiri is really telling Zarqawi that he must prepare in case the Americans pull out quickly. And Zawahiri is very nervous because he fears that if the Americans withdraw from Iraq, the Al-Qaeda element, this 5% or so of what's going on there, would collapse, that these young jihadists would throw down their arms and go home because they are really there to fight the Americans. They're not really there to fight the Iraqis or other Muslims. They're there to fight the Americans. So if the Americans left, Zawahiri was quite nervous and quite concerned that this would lead to the disintegration of the Al-Qaeda operation in Iraq. And that's why he suggests to Zarqawi that Zarqawi start trying to pitch this idea of a caliphate, although a much smaller one. They're talking about trying to build some kind of enclave on the eastern Mediterranean. But even that isn't serious because it's essentially a way to sort of keep these kids from just leaving. So we know that from the Zawahiri letter. More recently, there was discovered a letter which was actually written by Atiyah, who was another top lieutenant of bin Laden, and it was written in December of 2005. And in that letter, also to Zarqawi, Atiyah is saying that he's basically counseling Zarqawi not to be so rash. He's offended. He's upset that Zarqawi, with his brutal tactics, has offended many of the Iraqis that are needed to sort of have some kind of alliance. And at that point, Al-Qaeda, ITFL, had sort of isolated itself from a bunch of the Iraqi insurgency. And so he's essentially lecturing Zarqawi to behave in a more rational way, in a more political way. Atiyah also says that it's important to move more slowly and that it's important to essentially keep the U.S. in place. And he says it's in our interest. He says prolonging the war is in our interest. So the top leadership of Al-Qaeda is saying in these communications, which are now in the possession of U.S. intelligence, that they want the United States to stay in Iraq because it serves Al-Qaeda's interests to have the United States remain in Iraq, that prolonging the war is in our interest, as Atiyah put it. So what we're really seeing is something quite different from what Bush is trying to pitch to the American people. Al-Qaeda is in a much more vulnerable position than he wants to present. They are fearful that if the U.S. left, they would disintegrate as a force in Iraq. And that what they really want is to prolong the war, which makes sense if you put it in the larger context, too, where the CIA and the U.S. intelligence community has concluded that the Iraq war has served as this cause celeb that has allowed Islamic militancy to spread across the world. It also fits with what the CIA concluded in October of 2004, that bin Laden issued that videotape because he wanted to make sure that Bush stayed in office for another 4 years and that Bush's policies were continued because they were playing into Al-Qaeda's hands. So what America is really facing is something very different from the way Bush is trying to sell it. He is no more being accurate with intelligence today than he was in 2002 and 2003 when he was exaggerating and essentially inventing aspects of the threat from Iraq. He's doing the same thing now, and much like that, he's not being called to task by the mainstream American press. While the major media now says, well, yes, of course, in 2002 and 2003, the intelligence was being inflated and twisted and exaggerated. But no one is really standing up to him today and saying, listen, look at this new intelligence. See what is the CIA and other elements of the intelligence community saying today about what's really happening in Iraq? Bush doesn't want that out any more than he wanted the information out in 2002 and 2003 that undercut his Iraq war plan. So what we're seeing really is a sort of a repeat of Bush being able to manipulate the American voters and population by playing up false information, exaggerating the fears, this idea of a global caliphate, while the real story, which is being pieced together by U.S. intelligence, is much different.
Yeah, I once again, I want to stress that according to CIA analysis, on the evening that the speech became public in 2004, bin Laden was going public specifically to work to keep George Bush in office, and that the statements, as they can be accessed from al-Qaeda people and the analysis by our own intelligence community, is that in point of fact, al-Qaeda does not want, and the Islamists do not want, the U.S. to leave Iraq because their presence in Iraq concretely benefits the Islamist cause. And this analysis coming from the very national security establishment on whose behalf Texas Air National Guard Bush professes to act.
Right. Basically, the American people are again being snookered by these exaggerated fears and actually the actions that are being taken play into the hands of these extremists. They do not undercut the extremists. And I think obviously whatever happens in Iraq, if there is some kind of withdrawal or not, things are not going to be pretty. Mm-hmm. Withdrawal is certainly not going to be followed by a golden age of in Iraq. It's going to be a very bloody mess. But the point here is that if one follows the intelligence, the Americans staying the course, if you will not likely improve matters, and actually will be in accord with what al-Qaeda wants. Al-Qaeda understands that by having the Americans continue on this course, It allows al-Qaeda and other extremists to essentially polarize the Islamic world. And any revolutionary wants, first of all, to discredit the center. They want to sort of split the countries or split the populations. So you have people sort of having to take sides between either siding with the Americans and the West or siding with the Islamic extremists. That plays into the hands of al-Qaeda, as it does with any kind of radical revolutionary movement. So that's what we're facing, and I think it's a much different reality than Bush is trying to present as he goes around on these stump speeches where he's getting these great reactions from his audiences, but he's not telling them the truth.
Alrighty, we are out of time on this side, Robert. What I would like to do, and we're going to resume this discussion in the second side, in the beginning of the second side, I'd like you to relate to the audience some of the substantive details concerning Consortium News, the availability of your books, Hidden History, and Secrecy and Privilege, because as is the case with every institution, what Tacitus noted, pecunia nervus belli, money is the sinew of war, or in this case, journalism. So we will let's begin side two with that point. We have been visiting with Robert Perry, the main man, so to speak, of the ConsortiumNews.com website, and also the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 575. This has been recorded on November 5th of the year 2006. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.